funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Greek mythology is hard to resist with its tales of powerful gods and courageous mortal heroes. But what if those stories were not entirely the stuff of imagination? Journalist Christopher McDougall helped touch off a nationwide interest in the benefits of barefoot running with his last book about the Tarahumara tribe of northern Mexico. His latest project took him to the Greek island of Crete. It was there that a band of real-life resistance fighters relied on survival skills and extraordinary physical conditioning born of lifetimes spent in rocky, harsh terrain to carry off a daring abduction of an occupying Nazi commander against incredible odds. Christopher McDougall's new book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. Chris, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I would love for you to start this conversation with a description of the kidnapping event that inspired the book. It's both dramatic and elegant in a way that makes it read almost like the treatment for some kind of blockbuster heist film. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. That's what really captured my imagination with this. It was such a bad idea right from the get-go. No general had ever been kidnapped from the field of battle before, and for a very good reason. It just makes no military sense to commit your best soldiers to going after such a well-protected target, particularly when there's nowhere to go. On Crete, you know, it's an island. So once you capture the general, you're basically running in circles, being pursued by land, sea, and air. So that's what was so beguiling about this gambit in the first place. It was a long shot attempt to pull off something that had never happened before, but it was done for the most beautiful of reasons. The kind of misfits who schemed this up in the first place thought, enough with all the cruelty and violence and bloodshed, let's try and do something that will be effective and yet kind of gentle. Let's do this without hurting anybody.
They left a note in the last spot that they had the general.
Yeah, that was the point. So, well, one thing, too, they were being really careful about was they didn't want the Germans taking any reprisals against the Cretan population. They wanted to make sure that if anybody was going to be held accountable for this, it was going to be the rebel fighters and the British special agents who pulled it off. So, yeah, they took the general's car, and they left a very sort of jaunty, very British 1940s note on the windshield saying, we have done this. This is our responsibility. And by the way, we are heartbroken to leave behind this beautiful car.
What kind of presence did the general, is it pronounced Kripe? Is that how he said his name?
Yeah, Kripe.
Okay, Kripe. What kind of presence did Kripe's Nazis have on Crete? And why was the island such important territory for the Nazi occupiers in the first place?
This is one of the lost facts of World War II history. The history is written by the big powers that won it, and what's sort of lost in all that are all these smaller pivotal turning points that happen in between. So what happened with Crete was something pretty simple. Once Hitler had conquered all of Western Europe, all he had to do in order to win the war was defeat Russia, and Russia was a sitting duck. You know, we think of Russia as being this big superpower. Back in the 1940s, Russia was a shambles. Stalin didn't trust any general who was powerful enough to topple him, so he kept purging all the top ranks in the military and putting in these inept stooges to lead the Red Army. So once Hitler turned his attention on Moscow, there was really nothing in his way. All he had to do was power in and out, and he would have won the war. There was only one thing which could have stopped him, and that was the weather. One thing people know from a long, tragic history in Russia is you got to get in and out before it snows. So all Hitler had to do was lock down Crete. And the only reason why Crete was important was because it was just that sort of essential stone in the river, that stepping stone between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. Once he has this tiny island that he can use as a transit spot, a place to store all of his supplies and extra troops, then he pushes on to the east and he wins the war. And that's where things got really hairy, because the Cretans had plans of their own, and they did something that no other country in the history of the war had done, which was they organized an underground resistance the day the Germans arrived.
How did this story blow open your view of the classic hero narrative, and who might be included within it?
Well, you know, it was kind of a peculiar thing because I came across this by accident. I was originally doing research for Born to Run, and I came across these references to a guy called the Cretan Runner. And I assumed this was some kind of, you know, ultramarathoner or marathon runner. And then I realized, oh, no, actually, he's the wrong kind of runner. He was a foot messenger between the resistance bands. So I put that aside. It didn't really pertain to Battlebonnet Indians and barefoot running. So I put that aside. And then later, after I finished Born to Run, something about it kind of intrigued me. So I circled back and began reading up. And then what I found was an equally intriguing story because the Cretan runner, a guy named George Sikandakis, was often running like 50 to 100 miles at a time through the mountains, living off the land to deliver messages back and forth between these resistance bands. So I just became intrigued by the simple practical question, like how on earth do you pull off ultra-endurance feats like that without any kind of assistance?
And when you say living off the land, he was like eating hay.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes. George left behind a wonderful memoir about his adventures, and it was verified by lots of the resistance fighters who met him. Everybody basically signed off and said, everything George said is the gospel truth. And one of the things he talks about was an episode where he went for 3 days running through the mountains, living on a diet of boiled hay. And boiled hay basically has no calories. He was living off of like McDonald's coffee. It was just brown water. And yet somehow he was able to tap in to fuel sources in his own body that allowed him to do hundreds of miles without any input whatsoever.
He was a sheep farmer by trade. Is that how he earned his living?
He was a shepherd, yeah. He was the meekest little guy. Little guy, liked to write poems, and was nicknamed the clown. Until the war began, this is the least likely person to ever play a heroic role in any kind of conflict.
Okay, so this gets to another sort of theme in this book. How did a shepherd become such an elite athlete?
That's one thing that the Cretans and the Greeks themselves would not have been surprised by at all. Mm-hmm. And this is, to me, was the real turning point and what really hooked me into telling this story. You know, we've grown up in the U.S. with this notion that a hero is somebody else. It's someone who's bigger, stronger, tougher, more brave. And to the point where, almost of absurdity, anytime you see someone on the news who's just done something amazingly heroic, who just rescued someone from a fire or saved someone from a flood, I guarantee if that person is interviewed on camera, they will always say the same thing. I don't consider myself a hero. And I think the reason why they say that is we're really confused as to what that word means. And so we assume, well, it's not us. It's got to be other people. But the Greeks didn't have the luxury of relying on, like, 911. You know, we sort of outsource every crisis to somebody else. Someone steals your car, you call the police. Your house is on fire, you call the fire department. But the Greeks had to only rely on themselves and each other. So what they did was they looked at every person as having the essence of a hero inside them. And all you need to do is train yourself a little bit, and you can bring those talents out. And that's essentially what happened with George Sikandakis, the Cretan runner. By living on Crete and growing up in that ancient Greek art of the hero, that tradition, he was ready when the moment arrived.
What did you understand about the story when you actually arrived in Crete yourself and you could get a sense of the topography and what it felt like to breathe the air?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I just have a poor imagination, but things in my mind always seem easier than they are in reality. So when I got this idea of recreating and retracing this route, I thought, okay, cool. You go to Crete, you hike around a little bit, you talk to some people, and you're done. It was kind of the same mistake I made with Born to Run. Yeah, you scan in the Copper Canyons, you know, walk around, talk to some people, and you got a story. What I keep forgetting to anticipate is that the reason why it's really easy to hide in these places is because the mountains are really steep and the topography is brutal. So one thing that the Cretans had as an advantage against the German occupiers is that the mountain country is just brutal. There's reportedly 10,000 caves on Crete. Most of the island is still unmapped and really wild and rugged. Great place to hide.
It's worth noting that the team working to pull this off was made up of natives of Crete and also, as I think you referred to earlier, some allied special operatives. But these British operatives were not like your typical Army Ranger, Navy SEAL warriors. They were academics.
Yeah. Well, the thing about this was, again, we've developed this idea that special forces are like the knife edge, the cutting edge of the spear. But back in the 1940s, there were no special forces. This was like a brand new innovation brought about by desperation. In World War One, when you had combat forces, you basically had two armies, one against the other with a big trench in between them. But World War Two, Churchill realized his back was up against the wall, so he couldn't play by the old gentleman's rules anymore. He had to start playing dirty the way opposition forces had always played against the British. You know, in South Africa and Ireland and in India, it had always been these undercover operatives who had done the most damage against the occupying British forces. So Churchill said, you know what, if it works against us, let's make it work for us. But here's the thing about it, though. Because this is a brand new idea, and the military was kind of suspicious about it, they didn't want to devote any really good soldiers to it. They weren't going to put the good guys behind enemy lines. They're going to put, you know, the riffraff. So the people they recruited for these special forces operations were basically the people that they didn't want anywhere else. So it would be aging academics, librarians, archaeologists, people who knew a little bit about foreign countries, spoke a little bit of a foreign language, and were pretty much expendable.
Did they speak modern Greek, or did they have, like, ancient Greek backgrounds?
That's a funny thing, too. So here you get a couple of guys. They're archaeologists. You've got a guy who is head of classics at Oxford. They literally strapped him in parachutes with no training, dropped him out of a plane. They fall into the mountains, and when they arrive with these rough and ready Cretan shepherds, they are speaking a variety of the language which has not been heard in 3,000 years. So this is their way of trying to, you know, organize a fighting force. But what was so cool was it worked.
So how did the British special operatives get together and collaborate with the Cretan resistance?
One thing about Crete was, you know, and as romantic and wonderful the story of the Brits are, because some of the characters that went into this operation, a guy named Patrick Lee Fermor, who basically walked and womanized his way across Western Europe as a teenager, staying in castles and, like, bedding down countesses, and a guy named Zan Fielding, who was a itinerant painter who popped up behind enemy lines. As romantic as their stories are, you've really got to give the lion's share of the credit to the Cretans. And the reason why was because, you know, Crete, as this outpost in the Mediterranean, it had been attacked and colonized for thousands of years. So the Cretans were very used to strange boats arriving full of enemies. And so they knew how to tell a friend from an enemy and how to quickly mobilize. So basically what happened was you drop these playboys and poets behind enemy lines. If it wasn't for the Cretans, they would have been dead in the snap of the fingers.
And the Cretans, I suppose, had to decide quickly whether to trust these people and took a calculated gamble.
You know, that was one of the real wonderful things about them was there were lots of opportunities for them to give up on the Brits and the Allies, and they didn't. There was a rudimentary and pretty ragged group of Allied defenders on the island when the Germans came, and once they came under pressure, they basically abandoned Crete. They all hopped on their boats and took off. It was a big Dunkirk exodus. And the Cretans literally stood on the beaches and said, when you come back, we'll be waiting, we'll be ready.
My guest is author Christopher McDougall. His new book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Christopher McDougall. His newest book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Chris, parkour plays an interesting role here. And first of all, I think that may be a term that not everyone is familiar with. Its acknowledged father was this guy, George Hebert. Can you talk about what inspired his approach to fitness and how that evolved into what today is called parkour?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating thing because, you know, it's one thing to applaud a guy like George Sikandakis for the way he can sort of move goats-like across the Cretan landscape. But to me, the important thing is this something we can learn ourselves? You know, what are the transferable skills? And what I discovered was the kind of fitness and agility that the Cretans were tapping into is something that other people had studied and mastered throughout history. And one in particular was a French naval officer named Georges Hebert. Now, Hebert, in the early 1900s, was positioned on a troop ship just off the coast of the island of Martinique. And when the volcano in the center of Martinique began to explode, Hebert and his fellow crew members jump into a lifeboat, and they begin steaming towards shore, hoping to save lives. And what they saw in front of them scarred Hebert for the rest of his life. He saw tens of thousands of people dying right in front of him for reasons which could have been avoided. They just couldn't master these little basic animal skills which would have saved their lives. People couldn't swim a few yards offshore to climb into the boat, or they couldn't pull themselves up a rope. And most horrifying, he watched parents struggling to pick up their children, and the children weren't particularly heavy. But if you've ever tried to pick up a human body, even a small one, they're kind of ungainly. They're not balanced properly. They don't have handles. And so even though a child only weighed 40 pounds, they were slipping out of the parents' grasp. And a bear, after this horrifying experience, went back to France and began wondering, why is it the humans are incapable of saving themselves? Every other creature can run and jump and fly and swim to safety, yet somehow we've lost that animal skill. And of course, the explanation was pretty apparent to him. It's because when you look at children, these 4 and 5 year olds, every day they are practicing survival skills. They're running and jumping and kicking and fighting. You know, like, how often do you tell a kid, like, get off that. Don't play with that. Put that down. Stop kicking your brother. But what Hebert realized is they're practicing ways to stay alive. And then we take this healthy animal at age 5, and we sit it down in a chair and say, okay, now don't move for like 15 years, you know, until you graduate high school. And that's essentially the problem, was we have lost the natural method of moving. So Hebert created something called the natural method. And essentially all it is the kind of obstacle course training that's now become so popular with Spartan races and Tough Mudders.
As I was reading the book, I made a note to myself that you are clearly more of a mountain goat than a gym rat. what's so wrong with working out at the gym?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's become a sore point. Like, when I hear that phrase, working out at a gym, I have visions of mushroom clouds popping up over cities across America. I just want these things to be eradicated. The problem with the modern gym is it took a good idea and it turned it into a money-making machine. Gyms back in the old days, like when Teddy Roosevelt was a sickly teenager and he first went to a gym, it was a big open space full of like medicine balls and Indian clubs and these cool things called strength rings. Strength rings were basically just two iron rings and two people would hold one end in each hand, so they were sort of facing each other. And the goal was to pull the other person off balance. But the problem with an exercise system like that from a profit standpoint is you can't fit a lot of people into that kind of a gym because they're moving around a lot. Movement is the enemy of profits. So what happened in the 1970s was we adopted a whole new method of exercise, and it was based on bodybuilding. It was based on trying to turn yourself into someone who looks like Dwayne Johnson or Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the way you do that is you sit someone down in a machine, and you have that person move one muscle part over and over again in a repetitive motion that tears the muscle down so it swells with blood. That muscle looks bigger, but it's not functional at all. So that machine model makes a ton of money for gyms, but it is the absolute worst thing for getting people into shape.
Meanwhile, people who are doing this, you know, natural method, now we call it parkour, they're kind of using the world as their obstacle course, they tend to be a lot leaner than your average devoted gym goer, weightlifting gym goer.
Yeah, so, you know, when did size ever become synonymous with strength? When did size become synonymous with usefulness? And again, when you look back through history, the strong people were never particularly big. You know, this whole idea of size only became current in the 1970s. You know, and why? Because we developed steroids. In the 1970s, we created chemicals which could bloat humans to sizes which had never been seen before. But, you know, it was kind of fascinating to read up on Hercules. Hercules is never described as particularly big. He's always described as being resourceful, as strong, but never as much bigger than other people. And to me, that's what the ancient Greeks were zeroing in on. It's all about usefulness, not about bulk.
Many times when people run, if they have access to like a beautiful track or trail near, you know, where they live or where they work, they're so excited. And the goal seems to be to find the most smooth and level surface upon which to run. You're a fan very much of getting off the beaten path.
Yeah, and yeah, I think it's one of the sort of tragedies of modern life is we have compartmentalized movement into one little like 45-minute segment of the day. And in that regard, something sort of flat and measurable where you can time it and be done with it is kind of convenient. But really, movement is about unpredictability, variability, and true obstacles. So, and again, when you think about how we survive for most of our time on the planet, we were trying to be in remote, difficult places, not in big, open, obvious ones. So, again, you know, we had this sort of conflict between what our bodies want and what we're willing to provide them.
So is it possible enough, if the goal is to get fit enough to be useful, is it possible to get fit enough to be useful going through the motions of a job that requires, say, physical labor? Do we have to find, you know, that time, that 45 minutes of workout time, or can we work that into the course of a regular day?
Well, there are two approaches to that. One, I think, is really optimistic and playful and fun, which is parkour. And parkour was something that I was pretty willing to dismiss early on. I knew that Georges Hébert's legacy was the creation of parkour. Once he created natural movement, it gradually evolved into this urban street gymnastics known as parkour. But and I kind of looked at it as something kind of show-offy and stupid just for, you know, 18-year-old punks. But once I started to look into it, a couple things about parkour became apparent. Number one, I believe that those activities where the differences between men and women and ages are minimalized are the activities that humans naturally evolved to do. The things which are like built on upper body strength and explosive power, those were created by men for men. But they don't really have any bearing on anything that humans have done naturally. So parkour is one of these activities where when you see people doing parkour, at a glance, you can't tell who they are. You can't tell if they're 18 or 38. You can't tell if they're men or women. It's the same skills and the same proficiency level. The second thing that's super cool about parkour is you can do it anywhere, any environment. You can do it in suburbs, center of a city, out in the countryside. You can find obstacles which you can practice and play on. And finally, again, what's wonderful about it is you do a half an hour parkour, you can be a sweat sodden, exhausted mess. You can get all the activity you need in under 60 minutes.
Can you give us an example? And I know the idea is never to do the same thing twice, but can you give us an example of what would qualify as a really good sweat-soaking parkour workout?
Well, here's something I do, too. So, you know, one thing when you start doing parkour, your vision starts to change a little bit. You start to assess your landscape for possibilities in whole new ways. So, around my house, I've lived here for 15 years. I've run on the same roads forever. Once I started doing parkour, I started noticing fences, which I never noticed before, or low tree limbs. So when I go for a run now, I get down the road. There's a little abandoned bridge with a railing. So as soon as I get to that railing, I'll practice doing a thing called a turn vault, which is a simple vault where you sort of twist in midair. I'll do a bunch of turn vaults. Then I'll climb up on the railing, and I'll do a tightrope walk back and forth. And then I'll practice what's known as precision jumps, where you jump off the railing and try and land as precisely and lightly as possible. And then I'll continue my run, and then nearby there's a hill, kind of steep, not very long, but instead of running up the hill, I'll drop down onto feet and hands and bear crawl up the hill, and then bear crawl backwards down the hill. And again, by this point, I'm only now a mile and a half into my run, and I'm pretty wiped out. And then you can just continue to either come up with obstacles or just continue running.
Is it best done by yourself or with a buddy?
Either one. You know, either one. I find that, you know, humans are hunting pack animals by nature, and that the more you're with someone else, the more energized and, excited you are by the workout. But again, that's the cool thing about parkour. It's either in a group or on your own.
All right, let's go back to our brave resistance fighters on Crete. How did they plan their operation and start to train for it and assign roles to the different players?
Yeah, planning is a very flexible word in this case because the guys who originally came up with this idea, one guy was named Patrick Lee Firmer, Patty. And Patty was, again, he's a character out of like an Evelyn Waugh novel. He was just so happy-go-lucky and beloved and liked to wear costumes. And he was on leave. He had left Crete and gone back to Egypt on leave. And the very fact that he was on leave was an accident because he accidentally got on an evacuation boat. Someone else was supposed to be on the boat. Patty just went to deliver a message, and then the boat left with him sitting on it. So he goes, oh, I might as well leave. He goes back to Egypt, and he was set off on this round of epic drinking parties. And one early morning, literally sitting in a bathroom with a buddy trying to get over a hangover, they started discussing this idea of whether they could kidnap a general. And so they stood up, and they started to actually diagram on the steam in the bathroom mirror exactly how they would do it.
And this, again, you know, generals don't tend to be left alone for very long. This operation was going to require people going into the very heart of the thing that they wished wasn't even around.
Yeah, that was the good news and the bad news. The good news was that because it was so unlikely, there was that little underdog's hope that they could pull it off. Nobody really expected it because it was just too nuts. And the second thing was, there was a happy little accident. There was a bend in the road between the general's headquarters and his living quarters. And he was a little concerned about that bend in the road himself. He thought that's the one place where his car was going to have to slow down in order to navigate the turn. And so he had actually 2 days before had ordered the troop garrison to put guards at that exact bend. He was concerned about snipers shooting him. So he ordered guards at that bend. So, and the thing about it was, the resistance had no idea that this order had gone down. But they independently came up with the idea of, like, hey, you know what? Let's grab a couple German uniforms and position ourselves right there and, as if we're traffic guards, and stop the general's car. So their impulse happened to match what was actually going down in the German command at that time.
What kind of shape was the general in, and how did they spirit him all over the island?
Again, the second part of the problem was that Patty, being a true romantic at heart, he was insistent that this be a bloodless operation. He wanted this to be a magic act. He wanted, you know, there were 80,000 German soldiers on this island, and he realized, look, we're never going to defeat 80,000 soldiers, but maybe we just got to get one of them. So if we make Kripa disappear into thin air and then magically pop up 2 weeks later off the island, that's got to make every single other soldier think twice about ever going off into the woods or ever going off on a hunt for resistance fighters. So, again, that was the beauty of the plan. But, again, the difficulty is you've now got a guy who isn't particularly happy about being force-marched up and over the mountains. So when they grabbed the general, at that point the general was pushing 60 years old. He'd been behind a desk a lot of the time. He was not in the best physical shape. So suddenly you got the problem on your hands of not only outrunning 80,000 pursuers, but forcing a general to step along with you.
How did the Germans realize that they must still be on the island?
Yeah, it's kind of unclear. It'd probably be because the Brits tried a little too hard to cover their tracks. What they did was they ambushed the general's car on that lonely stretch of road. The car came to a stop. they quickly overpowered the driver, who was armed. And the Granada General, again, who was putting up a pretty good fight, he was kicking and punching, but they subdued him. Then they split into two bands. One band took the general on foot up into the mountains, and the second band took the general's car down toward the waterfront. And, of course, the guy they put behind the wheel, Paddy, didn't know how to drive. So he's, like, grinding along, shredding gears as he's huffing down the road in the general's car. And then, you know, before they left the car, including that jaunty note on the windshield, they scattered all the stuff around. They scattered, like, an Agatha Christie novel and a bunch of Cadbury chocolate bars and British cigarettes and a British commando cap. And to me, like, that was probably the hint to the Germans that something was wrong, was that there's just too much stuff. They'd only been in the car for 20 minutes, and there shouldn't be all that garbage there.
From the Cretan and the, you know, British perspective, this is a very charming story. We should say, though, that the Nazis had real mayhem planned for the people of Crete.
Yeah, it was it's one of these terrible stories. When we went on Crete, I was there, luckily, to be guided by a guy named Chris White, a British social worker who's devoted himself to recreating every aspect of this operation. And one thing you find even on Crete today is you walk in those mountain villages, you find people who still remember how awful it was under German occupation. You know, because the Cretans were the only people who instinctively and immediately formed into a resistance operation, they really did a lot of damage when the Germans first invaded. And so Hitler's response, once they occupied the island, he said, I want you to govern this island with extreme brutality. Anybody puts up the slightest bit of resistance, you put a bullet in their head. You burn villages to the ground. And that's, again, the horrifying reality of what it was like. It's fun to focus on the daring adventures, but the day-to-day life under German occupation was horrific.
We're speaking this hour with author Christopher McDougall. His new book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Christopher McDougall. His new book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Tom in Denton, who asks, can you explain a little more about an Egyptian shipping port, the disguising of an Egyptian shipping port that caused Nazi bombers to miss the actual port and bomb the fake one?
I'm sorry, I've got a really crackly phone. I didn't hear the last part of that question.
The disguising of an Egyptian shipping port that caused Nazi bombers to miss the actual port and bomb the fake one.
I'm so sorry. I can't make that out at all.
All right. Okay. Can you hear me? Are you able to hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. But again, this I'm really embarrassed by this. We have a bad phone line out here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, when it rains. So, you know, I couldn't make out the actual question.
Okay. Well, we can maybe come back to it a little bit if
sure.
Things clear up a little bit. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Amber in Coppell. Hi, Amber.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
My question was in regards to movement and creating strength, if things like yoga and dance would fall under that category, or if he still considers them to be too restrictive to really get that kind of strength and agility that he's discussing.
Thanks for your call.
You know, it's funny. According to natural movement people, yoga, no, dance, yes. A lot of the natural movement people are sort of rabidly anti-yoga, and this is something I asked them about. There's a guy named Erwan LaCour who created something called MoveNat, and it's based on George Ebert's original principles. And if you say the word yoga around Erwan, you'll just watch the steam rise off of his head. And the reason why is he thinks that yoga is this sort of modern bastardization of what movement's supposed to be all about. And he's got two problems with it. Number one is yoga is asking muscles to do something that they don't want to do. You're forcing the muscles into uncomfortable positions. And his point is, if the muscle doesn't want to do something, don't change the muscle, change the movement. And his second problem with yoga is that it's so stationary, that you're just standing in one pose and holding it. And to him, that's kind of useless, that what you really want to do is be fluid and moving across your landscape. And for him, that's where dance comes into play. Like, dance really evolved from what humans have done naturally in the physical environment, which is becoming agile, silent, light, and using all four of their limbs and not just two of them.
What did you learn about the magic of elastic recoil? Excuse me.
Again, a real surprise. I sort of grew up in that same notion that muscle is king, that if you want to get strong, you rely on muscle. But there has been this growing body of evidence that the real player in the game is not the muscle at all, but the fascia. And fascia is just all that elastic recoil tendon, all that, you know, if you ever like cut into a piece of raw chicken, you see that sort of filmy stuff. That filmy stuff is in all of our bodies, and there's way more fascia in your body than there is muscle. And basically what they liken it to is like the string on a bow. Like, it's the string that's really propelling things. And the kind of examples you get when you want to talk about strength is, if you think about a baseball pitcher, a lot of times the guys who are playing baseball are not the most like physically fit-looking specimens, and yet they can throw a ball at 110 miles an hour. And the reason why is what they're doing is turning their bodies essentially into like human catapults. And that by perfecting that ability to use your fascia, you can tap into way more strength than you can by relying on muscle.
So how do we start to make it work for us?
You know, that's where the basic... the basic answers become prominent. Georgia Bear's idea was all the lessons you really need to learn, you knew at age five. That the kind of games kids are playing, again, kids are not very strong-looking, not very muscular, and yet they can run all day, they can get over all kinds of stuff, they can climb up anything. They're really good, like, sort of falling on their back and defending themselves with their feet. And a Bear's and the Natural Methods idea, and parkour's idea as well, is that getting back to the sloppier and more natural way of moving your body become way more effective than these sort of stylized and stiff methods that we've developed. They even use like the sport of boxing. Like boxing, they said, is a terrible way to fight. Like no natural creature would ever sort of stand there, you know, face to face and use your fists to hit each other. It's a stupid way to fight. Instead, what would they do? They would wrestle and grapple and roll around the ground.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Emily in Frisco. Hello, Emily.
Hello. How are y'all today? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was so excited to hear y'all talking about parkour on the radio. I'm a parkour instructor locally here, and me and my boyfriend, he started this about several years ago, and we've been trying to bring it to the Dallas, the DFW Metroplex along with our team for the last several years, and we're running into a lot of obstacles helping parents and kids and adults just feel comfortable doing it and trying to find places that will be, safe for the community to come learn. We usually do a Saturday class in Dallas and Fort Worth. It alternates every single Saturday, and we try to teach for free to get people information about what it is, because nobody knows about it usually. I mean, thankfully, people know about it a little bit more here, but... I was just hoping I could get some advice on how to, talk to at least my college campus on allowing us to have a practice. I go to UT Dallas, and I've been really wanting to bring that there, and they're not quite sure because of liability. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for a call, Emily.
Yeah, it's a funny thing about parkour. It has developed such a stigma, and I'm not exactly sure why, but Dan Edwards, who runs London's Parkour Generations Teaching Academy, he tells a story about how he came up with this brainstorm of an idea. There's a borough in London, Westminster, high juvenile crime rate. So he came up with the idea of teaching parkour to essentially juvenile delinquents, you know, troubled young people. And his point was, look, you either have these guys running around the streets on their own, or you have them running around the streets with me doing parkour. And originally, the Westminster Town Council went berserk. They thought, what a stupid idea. You're going to teach these kids how to outrun the police. But they did it on an experimental basis. And at the end of 6 months, the police came back and said, the crime rate among the targeted youth has dropped 69% in the time you've been doing this program. And Dan said basically there are two things going on. One was they were giving these people a nighttime occupation. Secondly, they were also giving them ownership of the streets. And a lot of juvenile crime just basically comes out of disaffection and boredom. But if you make them feel that these are their streets and there's something they can do with them, then they're really going to feel like they have to protect them. So that was dancing. So in certain places, parkour has really skyrocketed. But I personally have run into the same thing that your caller was talking about. I was invited by my local library to give a talk. And I said, you know, something, I'd love to give a talk about parkour. And they said, never mind. If you're going to talk about parkour, we're going to cancel the talk.
Are parkour folks treated like skateboarders?
Yeah. I think maybe even worse, because at least skateboarders are trying to keep the boards on the ground. But parkour, there's this notion that the people are going to be doing like backflips off of roofs, and that there's going to be significant liability issues.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jim is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Thank you once again. And Dr. McDougall, I heard you the first time about running barefooted, and I've tried it. I like it. You're really swimming upstream on this one, you know, because a huge part of our culture and our religion is based on the idea that we don't want to admit that we have any biological or animal nature. So, I think a lot of our status system and who's going to do the work and who's better than everybody else. We've got all these stories in the culture about based on that we're not animals. So that's really abstract and general right there. But that's the best I can do right now. Let me one other thing. He's passed away, but there's a sociologist named Robert Bellah. And the article that comes to mind is called History of Habit. And there's a bunch of stuff out there, and I'm probably messing around in your bibliography. I enjoy your work. Thank you very much.
I think that was a brilliant point, and it's really what the heart and soul of this problem is that, you know, we have this weird notion of ourselves. We think of ourselves as these sort of fragile, cerebral creatures that need to wear clothing and need to wear special shoes and need to have shelter and need to have special diets. And the fact of the matter is the opposite. You know, we are pretty robust animals that can eat anything and survive under any circumstances. And it's our attempts to protect ourselves that actually end up harming us the most. The fact that we try to have our processed foods convenient in our kitchens and live inside these, you know, special protected houses and never have our feet touch the ground, that's what causes the problems. So I think that was a brilliant point. We have to remind ourselves that when we thrived the most physically was when we were letting our animal natures run loose.
I've been intrigued by the people who are looking into the question of whether all the time we spend in temperature-controlled environments could be a contributor to obesity. And don't get me wrong, I like my air conditioning here in Texas, but it is something that makes you think.
Yeah, and you know, we see it so many times, too. There's a brilliant study they did where they took two control groups, and they had put one in a room, a very pleasant room with nice music playing, and had them take a test, and they had the other group just walk around the block and then come back inside and take the same test. And the people who'd walked around the block scored much better on the cognitive test than the people in the room. Then they did something else. They took the same group which had walked around the block, and then instead of going outside, they just put them in front of a picture of an outdoor scene, and then they retested people. And just looking at a picture of the outside environment triggered something in their mind, and they actually, again, outscored the people who didn't have that view of nature. There's something in our animal instinct that really wants us to get back in touch with where we came from.
All right, let's quickly take one more call here. We have Justin on the line in Arlington. Hi, Justin.
Hello, ma'am. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment. I've parkoured myself for, I think, 5 to 6 years now, and I'm just so happy to hear this on the radio. This individual activity has changed my life. when I first started, I could only run a mile, and I had to stop a couple of times, and now I can do 4 miles without stopping. I used to have, like, zero confidence in my ability, and when I started doing this, it boosted my strength, it boosted my grades, it just boosted my friendships. It just really changed my life, and I'm glad someone's finally talking about this on the radio, because every time I try to do it at a school, I always have to deal with police, and they're telling me, don't do this, you can hurt yourself.
Well, there's that same concern again, that it's tough to find a good place to do this.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing about parkour, that the perception is the exact opposite of the reality, because when I talk to parkour people, and I've talked to dozens and dozens of them, again, they sort of come out of the woodwork, out of the shadows, because they're not really visible to most people. Yet, when you go around and you tap into parkour communities, you find lots of people around. But one thing that's been consistent is they don't get hurt. You ask parkour people about injuries, and it's almost never. And I think the reason why is that parkour is based on skills. It's based on mastering skills. And so the tiniest little skill becomes so enticing. If you try to do a precision jump, you try and land precisely on one spot and do it silently, it's a small skill, but it's so enticing, it's so intriguing, you never want to stop doing it. So just that one little tiny skill alone will keep you busy all day long. And so you don't worry about doing the big air stunts.
All right, Chris, tell us about Born to Run, the motion picture.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Your fellow Texan, Matthew McConaughey, read Born to Run, and he contacted the producers and said he was a fan of the book and wanted to be involved. So they asked him if he wanted to play Caballo Blanco, the white horse of the Sierra Madre. So that's where we stand. McConaughey signed on. There's a great screenwriter named Matthew Michael Carnahan who's coming up with the script. And as soon as those two forces unite, hopefully we'll have cameras rolling.
Does it feel riskier to you as the sort of owner of this project to have it be a narrative film rather than a documentary?
I was really lucky about one thing. I think typically people who get involved in adaptations are more interested in commercialization. But the lucky thing about this movie is that everyone involved was a fan first. So like Lorenzo Di Bonaventura, he makes like the Terminator. I'm not sorry. What was that film? The name slipped in my mind. Transformer. He makes the Transformer films and the G.I. Joe films. Yet he is a reformed runner. He was a guy that was getting overweight and out of shape, and he read Born to Run. So he came on board as part of a passion project. And in some ways, because the Tarahumara are so reclusive, I can see where doing this as a feature film would be more effective than trying to do a documentary.
The new book by author Christopher McDougall is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. Chris, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
I loved it. Thanks very much for the conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.